Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Thursday, September 22nd, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Download it, print it out, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows like this one that have been curated out by Jeannie Rice. That are links to it are on that same page where people have been stepped through the worksheet process. And if you choose to listen to those, they can serve as a powerful tutorial for you to help you get the most benefit out of that tool in the least amount of time. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often, as it frequently leads to comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And we often get reports that people's lives and quality of relationships improve the more they actively use these tools. You can also email us, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. You can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. And we'll do our best to address your comments, questions, answers, or testimonials on the internet show, and then, as time allows, we'll send you an email letting you know what date and time we address your comment or question, answer, or testimonial, and you can go back in the archives and listen to the comments. So, what is your comment or question? How can we be of service to you today? what's on your mind. When people let us know that, it makes it far easier to live into our intention with this work, which is to be of service. Yesterday, we had a show that talked about the admonition in Lesson 21 in the Way of Mastery, where it says, allow all things. And I had planned to go back and review that segment. And we had a caller that said, I'd like to ask a question about how the Course in Miracles seems to say that there is no world and there's nothing real out there. And that was right in line with what this lesson in the Way of Mastery says. It says, you have not known how the world is. You have only known your perceptions of it. And your perceptions are always a distortion of the actuality. They may be a major distortion. They may only be a mild distortion. But as Anil Seth, the researcher in perception, points out, his name is Anil, A-N-I-L. His last name is Seth, S-E-T-H. And as he points out, all of us, each and every day, all we can do is hallucinate our best guess, make up our very best guess about what's actually going on in the world around us, because light doesn't get into our brain. Sound, as we believe in it, doesn't get into our brain. Touch doesn't get into our brain. So our brain is simply receiving signals from its antennas, like the eyes and the ears and the nerve endings. The nerve endings for taste and smell and touch. And when those electrical chemical signals reach the brain makes a guess based on what it has experienced in the past. And our research scientists tell us that 80% of the data, the information that my brain is using to make a guess about what's going on in the world around me, 80% of it's coming from my mind about my past experiences. It's not coming from the light waves that are hitting my eyes. It's not coming from the sound vibrations that are hitting my ears. It's coming from my past, my experiences with similar situations. And then I make a guess. And my brain creates an image and a set of meanings for me about what it is it thinks is going on outside it. And that's the only thing that I have to create my experiences, unless and until I develop other sensitivities. I tune in to other levels of input, insight, intuition, gut feelings, the Christ mind, whatever you want to call it. Until I cultivate the ability to add different levels of input, my perceptions will always be either mildly or dramatically divergent from the actuality of life. And it's our choice, especially once we've learned about the active process of perception. It's our choice to stay with our distorted perceptions and argue for them, or to develop, to choose to cultivate and develop the ability to add extra inputs and intuitions and insights and perceptual shifts that allow us to see the truth of life and the energies and what this book calls, in an earlier chapter, the character channeling the book says, I was young, I was Yeshua 2,000 years ago, and I asked to be shown how to see the world the way the Creator sees the world. I kept looking for ways to see the shimmering radiance of the creative energy that's behind or underneath all of the perceptions that my mind creates and then tries to make me believe these perceptions are the same as what's actually happening. So where we left off, in the reading, in the review of Lesson 21, in the Way of Mastery, is that in allowance, you cultivate the very quality of forgiveness. And in this book, the word forgiveness means the dismantling of every false perception. It says, without forgiveness, it is impossible to awaken into the realization of the capital T truth that is true always. And why is that? Because judgment is the opposite of the kingdom. Where you believe in your perceptions, you are outside the kingdom. When you believe in any perception that leaves you in a negative state of mind, negative thought pattern or negative emotion, you can rest assured that you have been in error as you created your guess about what life is really like. And the text goes on and says, where forgiveness is withheld, you are literally making a choice to be outside the kingdom. As long as you hold on to your perceptions, you're choosing to stay out of the flow of life in your personal experience. It says, you have used the power of the mind to make a decision out of a desire to hold on to a perception, and thereby you have generated direct experience. You are the one who has kicked yourself out of the garden. Remember then that always forgiveness is essential. It is necessary for the atonement. Forgiveness is another word for allowance. And we speak here not of blind passivity, but we speak of a relinquishment within one's own mind, and that is all. I will relinquish within my own mind all of the perceptions I have created as a judgment against my brother and sister or against the flow of life. I will ask to be shown rather than argue for any perception that leaves me feeling a negative emotion or leaves me believing a negative thought. So we speak here not of blind passivity, but of a relinquishment within one's own mind, and that is all. It is a willingness to see the complete neutrality of all events. It is a willingness to let the Comforter remind you that separation does not exist. You can create a belief of separation. You can create an experience of being a separate entity, and yet all minds are joined, and all energy is connected. So once you step into the willingness to see the complete neutrality of all events, you will have the willingness to let the comforter remind you that separation does not exist, and that you cannot possibly make yourself guilty of sin and all the rest. So here's this first exercise in this lesson, where it has 9 statements. And the 9 statements include, it is not possible for you to be guilty of sin. And the recommendation is that we allow ourselves to act and respond to these statements over time as though they were a mind shifter. We write them at the top of a piece of paper, and then we read them and then see what our minds want to say to argue against it. Most of us in this culture, if they read a statement that says, it's not possible for you to be guilty of sin, one of the first things that comes to mind is, that's the opposite of what I've been taught. I've been taught that we are sinners. I've been taught that there is original sin. I've been taught that here's a list of things I better not do, or they're going to decrease my value or get me thrown in jail or thrown in hell for all eternity, etc. The text goes on and says, forgiveness is a relinquishment of what you have decided is true about the world. Forgiveness, then, is very much a self-centered practice. Of yourself, you cannot forgive your brother or sister for anything because, in reality, they have done nothing. Forgiveness is forgiveness of oneself for insisting on replacing reality with your own version of it, which is perception. So in other words, forgiveness is the dismantling of every false perception within your mind. The text goes on and says, allowance is like the petals of a flower opening to embrace the new dawn of a spring day. Allowance is like the melting of the ice that allows the river to flow. Allowance is like the removing of a cap from a bottle of sweet fragrance and enjoying it as deeply as you can. Allowance is the dissolution of fear. Allowance is transformation. The text goes on and says, when you have come to allow all things, to trust all things, you will have embraced all things. And only one who is larger than the thing that is being embraced can do the embracing. Therefore, whenever you feel imprisoned, it is because you have made yourself smaller than the world you perceive. And when you feel free, it is because you have remembered that you are the one from which all things have arisen. You're part of the creation. You are the offspring of the Creator. You are the vast sky in which all clouds and storms arise and pass away, while the sky remains unscathed, eternally changeless. That is freedom. And that cultivation of freedom is a free will choice. It is the result of the desire for the kingdom. As you come to truly forgive yourself, in other words, remove every false perception you have ever held about anyone or anything, as you do that, you will come to discover that it means relinquishing perceptions of yourself as well. For you cannot awaken fully unless you include yourself in the circle of your forgiveness or within the circle of dismantling the false perceptions. Ultimately, of course, you come to see that the very practice of allowance is really the act of allowing yourself to be truly the capital S self that you are. You will no longer resist the process of purification by whatever means the comforter uses for you. It simply will not matter anymore. Why resist it? All I want is to be one with creation. If it is dissolved in the mind in a split second, and you do not even notice it, fine. And if it requires great tears and great experiences out in the world, that's fine too. There is a difference. They're really the same. It's because you've relinquished, through allowing, ownership of your own pathway home. I relinquish the ownership of my own pathway home, and I ask to be shown. I don't know how to get there. I don't know how I created the mess that I'm in. I don't know how to get out of it. So I'm going to ask to be shown. The text goes on and says, because you desire the kingdom above all else, it no longer matters how that process is experienced. You no longer complain that it seems to be taking a long time. You simply enjoin yourself in the process. You let the great comforter take you by the hand and retrace the steps you once made in error. Each step requires allowance, which is forgiveness born of desire that has been purified of desire for that which imprisons. So I no longer desire to hold on to my perceptions about how tough and bad and wrong the world is, because that imprisons me. And I tune into this energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through me. I tune into the Christ mind. I tune into the one mind of the Creator. And I keep asking it to lead the way and to show me. And when I do that, the desire for those things that would imprison me is replaced with the desire for that which sets all things free. The text goes on and says, once your desire begins and becomes the kingdom, then the end of the journey is perfectly certain. School is out. That which the ego is cannot last. For the very universe, creation, the world around you will conspire, which means to breathe together. And all things will breathe together and conspire together under the hand of the Holy Spirit to create precisely what you require to be set completely free of all illusion. And secretly, you will have already agreed with the Comforter that it will be this way. Allowance, then, is as important as desire and is an aspect of that pathway, that foundation, whereby Christ remembers Christ and arises from ego's ashes to walk upon this plane and on any plane as the truth that is true always. capital T truth that is true always, is that there never was any separation and that all minds are joined and that you have absolutely as much value as any human being that has ever and or will ever live on this planet. The text goes on and says, remember that it is only the ego that will compare and contrast. It is only the egoic mind that thinks about another's path and wonders if perhaps their path is better than your own path. There is only the life that you are directly experiencing. And through desire and allowance, that very life comes to be embraced as the very means by which the Comforter is dissolving illusion from your mind. Of course, it is all based on the humility of realizing that the ego cannot awaken itself, that the Comforter is that agency given by grace that knows how to bring you home. The next section is titled Establish a Relationship with the Comforter. And the text reads, I highly recommend that you establish a relationship with the Comforter as though it were a relationship with a good friend, indeed the best of friends, until you reach a point in which virtually every decision is given over to that mind. Well, old buddy, should I turn left or right at the next intersection? You relinquish ownership of your life. It is only the ego that thinks it can possess life. Spirit knows that life possesses it. That is, life has birthed you. The mind of creation has given rise to you. You are the offspring of creation. You are not the owner of life. You are the recipient of life. Would you then be willing to make the decision to become a grand master of allowance? Think about it. Most of us right here say no. No, I'm not giving up the reins of control. I'm very happy with what I'm creating in my life, and my bank account is good, or I know it's going to get better if I do all of this law of attraction business, and I buy into the idea that I need to learn to play big, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be in charge. However, if you develop that willingness, as this book is inviting us to do, and you become willing to be led into developing developing allowance to the point where you become a grand master, as with most things, we need to begin at the beginning. And you can begin with the simplest of things, such as, I allow this toothpaste to taste exactly the way it tastes, with no complaint. It just is as it is. And my mind is telling me instantly, I know all kinds of people I've worked with over the years, and probably several on the call right now that are going to say, wait a minute, I can't just go around in life allowing everything to be what it is. There are injustices happening. There are tragedies happening. I can't just allow that. And what we've been trying to help people open up to is that this is not to say that I witness a tragedy or an injustice or an abuse, and I just walk by it and say, well, that's the way it is. That's not what this book is talking about. This book is talking about getting grounded in that very moment, getting in touch with my true nature as connected to all minds and as the flow of creative energy expressing in form. That I breathe and I soften my resistance to what's happening. And I ask to be shown, what's mine to do here as a representative of the Christ mind, as part of the flow of life in creation? That I choose to reconnect to my source. Michael Rice would call it that I tap into, I become aware of this total, perfect, conscious, active, present love, which is my nature. And then I ask to be shown, what's mine to do here? And then I let it flow. I let whatever urge or impulse or direction awakens in me allow me to add part of the flow of life and the creative energy as part of this soup or this dance or this orchestra that's playing, and I'm one of the instruments in the orchestra. I have become a conduit, a channel, a pathway for the creative energy, or the energy of the Creator, or the energy of love, or the energy of the Christ mind, whatever you want to call it, to express in this moment. And I begin by saying and training my mind to just be an allowance rather than all this judgment and contraction. And I begin with the simple things like the taste of the toothpaste, or the changing of the seasons. Would you be willing not to lament the end of the summer and the coming of fall? But would you be willing to experience that change with allowance, with acceptance? The text says, for rest assured, and please listen well, in the realm of the world, which is the realm of perception, the only thing that exists is constant change. Underneath it, there's a changeless reality, and that is something that pervades the changeable. But where there is resistance to change, rest assured there is a mind living in delusion. Wherever there is resistance to change, there is a mind living in delusion. The text goes on and says, remember that we have said unto you before that the awakened mind no longer feels any resistance to the things of time. It no longer tries to get rid of time. It no longer tries to make things stay the same. The awakened mind can embrace all things, trust all things, and thereby transcend all things instantly, even in the midst of change. That is not something that happens when we first start to move into the work of cultivating allowance. Most of us have had the experience of raging at change, grasping for things to stay the same, labeling the flow of life and its changes as bad or wrong or tragic or catastrophic. Most of us have had that experience. The text goes on and says, in your realm, be perfectly honest with yourself, in your realm, is there ever a moment in which change is not occurring? Can the body be the field of perfect silence? Hardly, because even if you stop your heart beating for a few seconds, there's still blood gently flowing through the veins. There are still thoughts arising, sounds coming in through the ears. Think about it. Even when you slow down and hold your breath, there's still movement within your system. The body is not something that can become changeless. The awareness of the body, the field in which the body arises, is changeless already. You are whole and complete just as you are. From Lesson 4 it says, when somebody asks you, who are you? Don't give them a label that you've learned from language and culture and family. Say, listen, who am I? What am I? I'm the extension of love in form. I've never been born, and I will never taste death. I'm infinite and eternal. I shine forth as a sunbeam to the sun. I am the effect of the Creator's love, and I stand before you to love you. That's the truth that they refer to as true always. The body is not that which is changeless, but the awareness of the body and the field in which the body arises, that is changeless already. The text goes on and says, can you come then to the field of awareness that can embrace all things which arise, change, and pass away, and yet not feel any obstruction in embracing and dancing with those things? This is a tough one for most people. We cling so much. We want our relationships to last forever. We want the bodies to last forever. We wail and moan and gnash our teeth when relationships come and go, when people we love drop the body and move on to the next phase of their existence. We're coached into that in this world. We are trained to be fearful of death, that transition that people call death. And this book says that we mistakenly call death. There is no death for the essence of who you are. But we're invited to learn to develop allowance, which will bring us to the point, if we cultivate it, in which we can embrace all things which arise and change and pass away, and we will not feel any obstruction in embracing and dancing with those things, with those people, with those possessions. And know they will be gone soon, relatively soon, in the field of time. The text goes on and says, for the mind that is free from the illusions of death is that very mind that learns to dance with death, to enter into any moment or relationship, knowing that because the body is engaged here, it must come to an end. In fact, it's already on its way to that transition that we mistakenly call death. The text goes on and says, the mind then that becomes the one who is no longer in fear, no longer in resistance, that is the mind that has forgiven all things, including itself. It has dismantled every perception of everything, including itself. And it's there in the present moment at a level of existence that the conscious logical mind cannot even imagine. And it is there embracing all things, allowing all things, trusting all things, surrendering to all things, and thereby transcending all things. That mind can embrace phenomena that arise and pass away and do it with passion, with joy, with aliveness, with innocence, with simplicity, because that mind understands it cannot taste death. The mind that understands, the mind that is beyond the conscious logical mind, understands it cannot taste death, and thereby it is free to embrace even the things that arise in time and will pass in time, embrace them with passion, joy, aliveness, contentment. That mind knows, simply knows, it cannot taste death. It literally transmutes death, even as death seems to be passing by. The highest state, then, of being is always a paradox. As soon as you try to think about it with the conscious logical mind, through your desire, you have come ever closer and ever deeper into the kingdom. And through your cultivation of allowance, the grace-filled willingness to know that which arises is already passing away, this is like water flowing through a fork. And you might as well not lament it. The mind that laments is a mind imprisoned in delusion. The mind that allows all things is the mind that is already free beyond all things. The last paragraph in that section, the last thing we'll read today, says, imagine that there has been given unto you a window through this window, as though your creator had plucked you out of himself and said, now I'm going to drop you in the field of time, and there's something I want you to learn, and you have just 30 days in which to learn it. Imagine in this little dream state we're creating here that if you did not learn it, your existence would be snuffed out, erasing your name from the book of life. Now, of course, that will never happen. That is just a way of getting leverage on yourself. If you need a little leverage, if you need a little nudge, if you need something other than the first bottom line observation, which says, if whatever you're doing isn't working, feel free to try something else. If you need a little push in the right direction, just imagine this is the most important lesson for you to learn. This is the key to being free rather than imprisoned. Learn to cultivate, be willing to cultivate, allowing all things, understanding the true neutrality of every event, every arising and every passing away, understanding at deeper and deeper levels, you are not your thoughts about your body. You are not your body. You are not your thoughts about life and love. You are not the sum of other people's thoughts about you. You are infinite and eternal. You have never been born. You will never taste death. You are shining forth as a sunbeam from the mind of the creation. You are the extension of the creative energy expressing in form. There is more to your true nature and existence than your conscious logical mind has ever or can ever comprehend. And you're here in the field of time, and an option exists for you to learn to play with your life and these experiences and these thoughts and emotions. And as this book would say, to not let seriousness enter your mind. but be at play in the kingdom. So that's all I'm going to read for today, and when we get together tomorrow for the show recording anyway, we will finish the second reading of that 21st lesson in the Way of Mastery. And we have some time. We have about 14 or 15 minutes for comments or questions, answers or testimonials. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, I'll be delighted to turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. The second portion of our show today, the second hour, will be another recording of the book. The Why Again book, as it's labeled in the recording. And it's anticipated that Michael and Jeannie are still traveling, wherever they're traveling. So, how can we be of support to you in the next 10 minutes or so? Area code 610, is this Susan?
Hi, Dr. Tim. I waited a minute to see if somebody else pushed 1. It is amazing to me that this lesson, allowing, is coming up now when humans have made such a mess of things that rather than being told how to fix them, we're being told how to live with them, which is a kind of solution or escape or I'm not sure what. But we really do need to hear this right now, because I think on my Zoom group yesterday we were talking about how helpless we feel, how sort of locked into certain negative patterns that we've set up ourselves. For instance, a simple example would be just going to the grocery store wanting to buy almond butter and finding that the only almond butter for sale is in a plastic jar. And you want the almond butter and you'd rather buy it some other way, but there's no other way. So you buy it and you're guilty. And, of course, you've been talking about how you're not guilty. But anyway, on the level I'm talking, you feel, well, I'm not really sticking to my convictions here. I like the convenience. The problem isn't something I can handle right now. It has to go to the manufacturers who have to change the containers to something that's earth-friendly and so forth. And we were talking about how we're not responsible. And I don't know where I'm going with that exactly, except I feel as if by myself I'm not really much of a very powerful mover or agent. I can stop using plastic bags at the grocery store. These little things we do, it seems like a big joke to me, in fact, that we talk about not using straws. Well, that straw is the tiniest piece of plastic. Of course, it's serious business using straws. But the problems are so huge. We talk about straws because we can actually handle thinking about straws, whereas the problem is much, much bigger than that. But anyway, back to this. It's wonderful that we are given technology and brain power perhaps to change the direction that things are going in. But in the meantime, we're also told how to live well now, despite how things appear. I guess that's not a question, is it? Are you still there, Dr. Tim? If you're there, I can't hear you. Oh, I will text you and see if you are there.
Hello again. Hopefully you can hear me. I am now turning back the microphone for Susan Bingham. Are you there?
I am. I just dialed back in. What happened, you know?
No, I just got cut off again, and it took me 3 attempts to dial back in. What I was saying was this work is about breathing, centering, reconnecting to the awareness of your true nature, and then asking what should you do about the straw. It's not about whether or not you drink from a straw, or whether or not other people should drink from a straw, or whether or not there are bigger things you can do for climate change. And that's not what this work's about. This work is about breathing and softening and connecting to your core. This is the ancient Aramaic definition for the word that got translated as something and something and then came out in English as the word faith. That word in the ancient Aramaic meant acting from the rooted center of your being. So you don't take an action until you've consciously connected with your true nature, the rooted center of your being. And you ask to be guided from some source that is wiser and more deeply connected than your conscious logical mind will ever be. So you don't grasp and churn and try to figure out at the conscious logical level. You breathe, you soften, you understand your true nature and the true nature of those around you, and then you ask to be shown, and then you act. That's all we're talking about. We're not here to debate whether or not we are warming the planet, or whether or not we should or should not use plastic. We're here talking about how if I sit and generate negative emotions about what's happening with the planet or who's using plastics or not, I'm misusing my mind energy and my capacity to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. I'm misusing it. That's what we're talking about. And that's a powerful, powerful process that every one of us can engage in anytime we choose to. Make sense?
It does. Can you say that again a different way? My apologies, but my mind is halfway around that.
Say what again?
Okay, you said
I'm basically saying that it's perfectly okay to have whatever opinion you want to have when you do it from anger and fear and sadness and hurt and constriction. You're tying yourself in knots. You're narrowing yourself as a conduit, and you can't extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. So if you want to be a crusader for the environment and for ecology and for renewable energies and for cleaning up plastics, by all means, go do that. There's nothing in this work that says you can't do that. This work is saying, as you do that, each step of the way, with every action you take, before every breath, before every thought, reconnect to your true nature and then act. Did that help it at all?
Yeah. I think what I did with it is to jump right out of the solution-making altogether because of a sense of helplessness, and went and sat in the relief of the idea that we need do nothing, which has been said, and we are invited to allow, as if it's okay. What is happening is okay because it's
it is okay, and we know it's okay because it's happening, and we are part of that flow of creative energy and the one mind into this physical realm. And if we open ourselves to this and ask, what's mine to do here, and how can we might be the person who extends the good, the holy, and the beautiful in a way that starts to completely reverse the issue.
Mm-hmm.
What this work is telling us is that that will not happen as long as I stay in the fear and the anger and the hurt and the overwhelm and the hopelessness and the helplessness. So it's okay however it unfolds, and to make, to bring myself, because I'm the only one, I'm the only thing truly at this level that we're talking about that I have dominion over. I have dominion over my own thoughts and the emotional states that I create by pouring that mind energy into certain thought patterns. It says, this is what I'm responsible for. I have the ability to go into constriction and generate all these negative emotions. I also have the ability in each moment to return to that total, perfect, conscious, active, present state of love. And that's the invitation with this work. So, I hope that's useful to you. You've helped us reach the end of our hour. Thank you so much again for putting your hand up. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Here is your second hour.
Unless a person has tools to support healing in their lives, painful realities remain hidden in their minds and bodies. I wanted to explore with Richard how these stored realities express. I marveled that people who have no idea that there are tools with which they can unload their burdens survive as long as they do. Richard, I hear loud and clear that you would rather not deal with your pain, but allow me to add another piece to the puzzle. What you hide from yourself is your disease.
Now, wait a second. How do you get from stored painful realities to disease?
Well, physicists tell us everything is energy. Think of the body as an energy field instead of physical matter. There are two main categories of energy relative to that field. There's disintegrative energy, which tears the human energy system down, and integrative energy, which builds the system up.
Well, now, what does that have to do with disease?
Well, pain is a signal of disease. Not disease, but dis-ease. It tells the system that somewhere within there is something physically, mentally, or emotionally out of place. It's not an enemy, but a friend in disguise. When we don't want to listen to the feedback the system gives us, it gets our attention by yelling, ouch, pain. The purpose of pain is to make our ears grow. If we refuse to listen by suppressing the warning, it will grow in intensity. Pain will not be ignored. Sooner or later, it gets our full attention, and we follow its guidance to correction, or we die. This applies to physical, mental, emotional, and relationship pain. Getting rid of pain without dealing with its message is like cutting the wires to the bell on a fire alarm. The fire alarm screams out to get your attention to tell you there's a problem. It demands, listen to me. If you refuse to listen by shutting down the feedback, things do quiet down, but the fire still rages somewhere. Sooner or later, the fire will break through and make you aware that it is burning. The longer it takes to recognize where the fire is, the more difficult it will probably be to extinguish. Killing the bell certainly has nothing to do with putting the fire out.
Pain is just a bell, warning us that we need to look out for something. I always thought you were just supposed to take a pill to make the pain go away, and that's how you got well. That's what I was taught.
Well, thinking that will sure sell a lot of pills. But shutting down the alarm without dealing with the fire that's burning will lead to total destruction. Obviously, pain held anywhere in tissue does not contribute to the health of that tissue or any part of the system. The only reason for pain, 100% of the time is the disintegrative energy that invites us to look deeper into ourselves and deal with whatever we've hidden there. Medical research is proving that every cell in the body stores information. Our dis-ease and our pain come from the energy introduced into tissue by the negative realities we store there and the drugs we use to keep those realities suppressed. The secondary cause of pain is the lifestyle we choose to keep ourselves in a weakened condition.
What? You've got to be kidding. Who would purposely weaken themselves?
Think about it, Richard. You can't suppress anything in an energy system that's at full vitality, right?
Yeah.
In order to suppress, something has to shut down the flow of energy in the system so that whatever is hidden remains that way. Show me someone who, say for instance, takes a drug for depression. If you remove their drug, what happens? They begin to remember what's been suppressed and will go back into that depression, right?
Well, that means the drug worked, didn't it? Without it, they feel depressed. With it, they feel better.
Depends on what you mean by worked, Richard. If sweeping something under the rug is your definition of work, drugs are doing their job. The action of most drugs, legal or illegal, including caffeine, nicotine, sugar, alcohol, or junk food, is to lower the vitality of the system sufficiently so that the pain we desire to suppress remains out of conscious awareness. Now notice, I said, out of conscious awareness, not gone or cured. It means only that we are no longer aware of it. If we use drugs to suppress pain, and the cause of the pain is still intact, sooner or later it will surface somewhere in the system, often under the guise of a side effect. What you can't see or feel, you cannot heal. However, pain is not required. It's only a motivator. If we consciously choose to motivate ourselves, then instead of no pain, no gain, our lives will be no pain, no pain.
Does that mean I should never take drugs?
There are benefits to the use of drugs in that you have better short-term function when you keep pain suppressed, but true healing is impossible in that state. Drugs in the hands of a true healer can be used to temporarily control threatening symptoms, and so they can save a life. However, they don't heal, though they can buy time to do the necessary inner work of healing. I went on to reinforce that healing does not come from a drug any more than a fire is put out by cutting the wires to the bell. He seemed to relate to the idea that drugs shut down the highly tuned mechanism of feelings and rob us of our feedback. The mind cannot show us what we are unwilling to see and therefore distorts every situation where there is denial. Drugs simply reinforce the blockages denial creates. They're like a physical form of denial. If one does not have and use tools with which to heal, drugs tend to become a way of life, a one-way ticket to degeneration. I shared with Richard a poem that sums up perfectly for me the whole topic of disease and our part in it. The poem's entitled Each Moment, and it goes like this. Each moment of love, each moment of giving, each moment of joy is a moment of living. Each moment of anger, each moment of lying, each moment of fear is a moment of dying. All our moments add together, like the digits in a sum, and the answer tells us plainly whether life or death shall come. That's a poem that was written by a man named Lord Martin Cecil. Powerful. Richard was grasping the concept that reality is the output of the human mind, not what is going on in the world, which is actuality. He expressed relief at understanding more about what drove his mind and caused his pain. He explained it had never occurred to him that what showed up in his mind, his reality, could possibly be different from what happened in the world, actuality. He acknowledged that he lived totally unaware that denial could distort the realities in the mind so completely. Grasping that principle struck a chord of recognition for him, and he volunteered an example.
I have never conceived before that what happens in the world could possibly be different from what shows up in my mind. The other day, I was in a restaurant enjoying a steaming cup of coffee when the waitress came by and took it. I didn't give her the chance to explain. I just snapped at her before I saw the fresh cup of coffee in her hands. She had seen me spill the coffee into the saucer and was attempting to keep me from making a mess of my clean suit. I have never thought in these terms before, but what you're saying helps me make sense of that situation. When I turned and saw her picking up my cup, I thought, don't touch my coffee. I was ready to attack. Now I realize her reality was probably something like, uh-oh, that cup is about to drip. I'd better grab it.
I wanted to bring the train of thought full cycle. Your underlying reality was probably something like, people take things from me. For her, it was likely, I take care of people. In the meantime, the actuality was she simply picked up a dripping cup. As we continue to focus on his experience with the waitress and the reality in him that was being triggered by this event, his insight deepened.
Now I see why people are confused by my behavior. I'm quick to accuse, and they have no idea why I'm upset. I understand now that my upset is really a reality in my head. I'm grasping the idea that my reaction to the waitress didn't have anything to do with what actually happened, except that it was a trigger. I'm sure my reality didn't even remotely resemble the one that was happening for her.
This initial insight provided Richard with a new perspective on actuality, his own and others' internal reality structures, and his responsibility for his life. He had understood the concept of a trigger and was delighted.
I feel great.
Good work, Richard. It's exciting to see through new eyes, isn't it? My experience is that most people think everyone is experiencing the same thing I am. Why don't they understand me? The truth is that at every moment, every person is experiencing a different reality, and seldom do our realities match exactly. If you don't make room in your heart and mind for other people's realities to be different, especially in your intimate relationships, there's going to be trouble.
Looking at things from that perspective, it amazes me that we even start to get along. I'm still a little confused, but bear with me. I need to clarify this. The waitress and 1,000 other people that I've done this to did something that in their reality was positive, something loving. The actuality of the event between us was neutral. I mean, after all, picking up a cup of coffee is just picking up a cup of coffee. She was trying to help, but her action was a trigger for me and for my reality. They're taking something away from me. I was thinking that. I attacked her to protect myself from losing something, a reality that was happening only in my own head.
Richard became quiet and all animation disappeared. Tears rolled down his reddened face and he could hardly speak. What's happening, Richard?
I'm realizing this happened all the time between my mother and me. I do something I thought she would appreciate, and instead I got yelled at or beat up on for it. I never understood why. No matter how hard I tried, I could never get it right. Living with her was like walking through a minefield.
Several still moments passed before Richard spoke again.
I wonder how many people I have destroyed with the same behavior. How many times have I treated others like that and not realized what I was doing? I don't think that there are enough apologies in the world for the people I've acted that out with. Boy, do I feel stupid.
Another long silence followed. I finally spoke. Sounds like perhaps you felt destroyed by your mother.
No. I love my mother. Why would you say that?
Well, as I listened to your clarification process, which was very powerful, you keyed into at least one of the reasons you attack so readily. You do it to protect what is yours. Your next step was to see that attacking was a pattern you learned from your mother. Listening to your perceptions of the interaction with her tells me a lot about the content of your mind. When I explained to Richard that the perceptual output of the mind always tells more about the content of the perceiving mind than about the perceived world, it made sense to him. He acknowledged that he had felt devastated by his mother. In spite of pretending that they had a great relationship, he avoids her even to this day. As I talked him through his fear of feeling sadness about what he'd uncovered, helping to create a safe space for him to be honest with himself, he spoke again of his fear of being destroyed by what might surface. Richard's fear of being destroyed was an old reality that needed to be exposed fully in order to be healed. I assured him that it was safe to look at whatever came to his mind. I invited him to be aware that a memory of pain is just a memory, and he did not need to re-empower his old pain as though it were true present moment pain. He had survived the trauma when he first felt it and locked the experience into his body. He would survive its release as the old energy moved out of the system. Within moments, through simple breathing and accepting that he was safe, Richard was feeling better and seemed surprised at how much easier it had become to breathe.
What happened?
Breathing through the surfacing of old hidden feelings allows the release. I suspect people will find you easier to get along with in the future, and you will probably see an easing of your relationship with your mother.
Oh, that's a relief. It's interesting to observe how these issues relate to one another. This really takes concentration and work, doesn't it?
Yes, it takes courage to face yourself and be vulnerable enough to feel your true feelings and honest enough to look at your real thoughts. I think the most important piece of work that you've done in the last few minutes, Richard, was the next link that you made. The thought that you destroyed people by attacking them needlessly. Did you notice that insight came on the heels of living with my mom was like walking through a minefield?
Mm-hmm.
That sequence of thoughts said to me that, as a child, there's a good chance you felt destroyed by what you perceived as your mother's attacks. It was probably too much for a young mind to confront, so the belief remained hidden until this moment. In the denial of that reality, your mind showed you only evidence of a loving mother, and at the same time, you blamed her for your hurt feelings. Richard's inability to own his thoughts of blame caused them to surface when least expected. They would run out of control and cause his actions to be out of proportion with the situations he faced. His blame thoughts became generalized. His reaction, attacking the waitress, for example, was generalized from the realities learned from early interactions with the mother who attacked to protect herself. This dynamic was the source of the emotional explosions that drove people away, the type of reverberations that often go on for decades after the original reason for blaming is passed. The belief that another is responsible for the output of your mind is a result of projection. If my suspicion is true, you attempted to keep the thought that you were destroyed by your mother hidden by projecting it into your mind's image of yourself. My clue, as I listened, was when you said, "I destroyed others."
I'm not sure I'm connecting it all together as you are, but it is a relief to be on this side of those feelings. It seems that it will be easier to be gentle with others.
What Richard had just gone through is called process. Holding the space of safety and love allows an unraveling of the jumbled unconscious realities that one holds in his or her mind. Rarely does one realize the dynamics that run beneath the surface when a decision is made or one compulsively engages in behavior they would rather avoid. The mind becomes free of its conflicts when we allow process to happen. In the past, if thoughts and feelings like this surfaced for you, it was probably in the context of conflict and anger, which just reinforced the pain and upset, right, Richard?
Yeah.
That continuous reinforcement makes it more difficult to confront feelings directly. It is having a loving space while issues are surfacing that shifts the energy into the healing mode. Are you willing to continue?
Yes.
Now, you grew up behaving toward others as you perceived your mother did toward you. Probably because you saw Mom as successful enough to model your behavior after her. That behavior worked to control you, but did it endear your mother to you?
No. No, I hated it when she did that. It drove me away from her.
So it accomplished the goal of controlling you, but you detested being controlled. You hated your mother's behavior, but you've become just like her? Earlier, you said another wife was leaving you. Has anyone ever told you they felt driven away by you?
How did you know that?
Well, the same way I figured out you felt destroyed by your mother. But let's hold that issue for a moment. I suggest you notice that controlling behavior does not serve you. It tends to destroy your relationships.
This certainly gives me a lot to think about. I'm really going to have to spend some time sorting through all of this. But I want to understand how you figured all of this out from what little I said.
Well, okay, let's look at the feeling of being destroyed by your mother. It appears that it was easier to admit that you destroyed people than to think of her doing that to you. If you believed treating others the way your mother treated you destroyed them, it makes sense that, in your mind, she did the same when she behaved that way toward you. Let's keep in mind that destroyed is a perceptual reality, probably a very complex one, which at this moment we'll not even try to break down. It is more important at this stage that you be responsible for accepting that pattern and modeling your behavior after hers rather than trying to blame your behavior on her. I see many people who take inventory of everyone else's faults but never acknowledge their role in adopting those faults as their own. This leads to more blame and is a justification many use to avoid accountability. It's a great excuse for staying in old patterns, letting oneself off the hook, and not having to change. With your waitress story, you clarified the difference between actuality, reality, and how the mind produces evidence to back up its preconceived notions and create its experiences. You and the waitress experienced the same actuality, or external event. However, your mind selected different evidence and built a different reality from it. From that event, her mind selected information and assembled it to present a radically different view of the situation. Your mind presented a reason to destroy, while hers saw an opportunity for service. Notice how each of your individual mindsets led to divergent realities and experiences. Richard had unraveled the stirring of unconscious realities that drove his behavior and led to his need to attack and protect himself. He had reached into the core of this work and healed major issues. We define healing as the surfacing and letting go of the disintegrative energies of unconsciousness and trauma. Who would think spilling coffee in a restaurant could lead to dealing with what is perhaps one of the deepest issues of someone's life? Every conflicting situation offers the same precious opportunity if you're willing to see it in the context of healing and allow your mind to construct a healing reality. We went on in our discussion exploring the evidential mind. Richard experienced his relationships with almost everyone as unpredictable and threatening to his power.
Why is it others make us feel what we don't want to feel?
The mind can only give you information supported by your internal reality structure. If your core belief is, I'm powerless and get attacked by women, your mind must process your experiences with women in a way that matches that reality. Any information not in sync with that belief is blocked. We discussed the idea that the mind is an evidential device and can access only the information one is willing to see. It then uses that information for building its realities, which are the mind's picture of actuality. When truthful information is blocked, it is impossible to build an accurate reality. If truth is not allowed, the mind cannot reflect truth. Richard, when you deny involvement in what happens, in effect, you instruct your mind to hide information relating to your responsibility in that event. The mind does not show you realities contrary to what it believes, because data inconsistent with its deeply held opinions is blocked or gated out. The mind has no choice when denied access to information or providing uncalled for data. It sees things that didn't happen if a belief that is different from actuality is triggered. When a belief is resonated by an event in the world, the brain cells that hold that belief will fill in data that is not present in the actuality. The data filled in will show up in the mind's reality as if it were part of the actual external event. Our belief systems, until purged of unconsciousness, tend to hold us in an hypnotic-like state. The mind can only follow your instructions to hide what you do not want to see and what your BS, your belief system, calls for. Gaining access to denied and therefore hidden information and undoing false beliefs are the keys to healing what is at the root of most repeated experiences. Here are a couple of examples that illustrate the point. In a laboratory experiment, cats were implanted with electrodes in an area of the brain that responded to sound. A device that created a clicking noise was placed close to the cat's ear. Each time the experimenters would click the device, the cat's brain registered a sound. A mouse in a bell jar was then placed in front of the cat. With the cat's attention and senses on the mouse, sensitive electronic equipment showed the clicking sound no longer registered in the cat's brain. All evidence of the clicking was blocked or gated out of the cat's awareness. It appears that only evidence that was important to the cat at the moment gained admittance to its awareness.
Now, how does that translate into human terms?
Well, the implications are many, especially in relationships. A computer analogy allows us to look deeper into the evidential mind's impact on human function. Consider a computer. It is incapable of choice and can only display information as directed. A person operating the computer selects or creates the programs that run on it. Since the computer can only follow directions and display information it has access to, the information available to the operator is limited by the program that's running. Like a computer, the mind can only use programmed available information and building a reality about the actuality on which it is focused. When a program is run in a mind, the information the mind can access and the quality of reality available are predetermined by the directions from that program. This fact is commonly recognized and called a bias, a slant, a mindset, or a prejudice. If a mind's blame program reads, find the guilty party and make sure that it's somebody else, the reality showing up in that mind can only reflect evidence that is contained in brain cells and is consistent with the program. All other information, internal or external, is gated or blocked out of awareness. It's simply not available for use in building the mind's current reality. If no consistent information is resonated by the actuality focused upon, the mind will hallucinate the needed evidence out of its past and attach it to the reality generated. A computer must be reprogrammed or a new program must be loaded in order to access information that is different from what is currently available. In a similar fashion, we must direct our minds to close the blame program and open the responsibility program if we're to see situations, others, and ourselves differently. If your mindset or program is, I'm right, you're wrong, it's settled, why argue? Your mind can only use information proving you're right in building its reality about you. It can only use information that proves another's error to build a reality about them. Any bias renders the mind incapable of providing accurate information about the actual world. I explained to Richard that my conclusion from these ideas and from my observation of human behavior is that the mind only permits into awareness information that supports its goals and prejudices. All other information is hidden. If we hold an emotionally charged goal of being right, the mind withholds all evidence that would show the truth of a situation, that we've made a mistake. The errors we refuse to acknowledge in ourselves, we blame on others. Blaming someone else for what goes on in our minds and using our hidden information to build our mind's image of them and the externalization of that internal process is the main block to healing. Once we project and attempt to place outside of ourselves what is internal, we cut ourselves off from forgiving what is hidden.
I know I project because I do experience identical realities repeatedly. I'm grasping that those scenarios are coming from my own mind, but I don't understand how that interrupts healing. How does projection work in relationships?
To answer his question about projection, more information on how the mind sets up what it sees was necessary. Once its reality is structured, the mind tends to see only in terms of its own contents and pre-programmed filters. It tends to place the meanings it contains on anything similar to its past. To a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. I then drew a picture on a piece of paper that resembled a house and ask the question, what is this, Richard?
Well, it's a house, of course.
Well, the truth is, it's just lines on a piece of paper. A man from the jungle who'd lived in nothing but caves would not look at those lines and say, oh, that's a house, and it has smoke coming out of the chimney. He does not have that meaning, that reality stored in his mind. He has no brain cells that contain that information. For him, there is no house in the lines on the page. House is a reality contained in and externalized by the mind of the observer, and only an observer with a house in their past would call the lines on the page a house.
You mean that there's nothing out there, that it's all in my mind?
No. The lines on the page are there. The external world exists. The point I'm making is that until we become aware, the objective world is just a framework which triggers what we filed away in our minds. Projection is a totally internal process and is a product of the mind using energies from the past triggered into activity to build a reality, the brain's graven image of that trigger. Our projections are false images which, when they are about someone or something else, are then externalized. Externalization is the pretense that an image into which we have projected, the false image engraved in our minds by the past, is outside of us, and they are the cause of our pain. Any reality or image we hold in our minds and believe belongs to the outside world is an externalization of that reality. Let's look at a simplistic example. Imagine a child whose home life was miserable, and, you know, a life of really severe abuse. If he sees the house, the lines on the page, what might happen? His blood pressure might rise, his eyes will probably bulge slightly, he might be preparing to run. He's given the lines a meaning from his past, a meaning contained in his mind. He then thinks, by externalizing that image and meaning, that the source of his pain is outside of him, that it belongs to the lines on the page. By that action, he's cut off from resolving his pain. Another child who loved lying on the couch in front of the fireplace while mom or dad rubbed his or her back sees the lines on the page. Images of wonderful food and family events might be triggered, and she projects the meaning her mind contains on the identical framework. Her mind does not generate a reason to run, though if she externalizes, she might think the lines in the page are the source of her pleasure. By that action, she may forever become dependent on circumstances in the external world for her state of mind, her happiness, her pleasure. Richard was beginning to grasp the subtle concept that a reality seen through a mind is internal to the perceiving mind. He fed back to me his understanding that as you look at the lines on the page, your mind instantly gives a meaning to them. The lines themselves have no meaning other than what your mind projects into them. I completed this aspect of the discussion with the idea, once again, that projection results from a belief that someone else is responsible for the output of your mind. When that belief is held, the mind uses whatever internal information is triggered by another for building a reality about that person. Our denied and suppressed attribute shows up as part of the image our mind builds of them. The mind, by externalizing, makes its images appear to come from the outside. It successfully documents that our pain belongs to them, that they're the cause of what we feel. The mind is a prism through which we view life. If there is any distortion, any resentment or negative feeling, that resentment or negative feeling clouds perception and colors our view of the world. This is why the first law of seeing is love. A mind that constantly holds the condition of love, regardless of circumstance, distorts nothing and is incapable of projection or externalization. When there is a distortion within the mind, we live within its meaning. If anyone who remotely resembles a person we hold a grievance against comes into awareness, we will instantly project our reality into our brain's image of them. We tend to believe that it is they who are the source of our grievance and pain, rather than accepting responsibility for the content of our own minds. Again, attempting to place our brain's image outside of ourselves blocks the ability to heal what someone triggers in us and leads to experiencing the same realities repeatedly. Only when we accept responsibility can we change the foundations of our perception. Denial keeps the true source of our pain hidden. We, as human beings, are usually taught to externalize and interact in relationships in a way that guarantees a cycle of repeated experiences. The first step in keeping that cycle going is to deny any involvement in causing our own pain. Then blame another and instruct that person in how he or she should change. If they refuse, we are taught to punish them to force change. If punishment doesn't work, we often leave or throw them out of our lives. In doing this, our painful reality is left fully intact, though it is now hidden again. This formula comes with a guarantee. If you use it, you can rest assured that someone who knows exactly how to access and show you the hidden parts of your mind will soon be knocking on your door again. It is interesting to note that we project and externalize our internal images to avoid pain, and by doing so, lock inside ourselves the very thing we're attempting to avoid. This, I think, is a good definition of insanity.
If I understand correctly, by blaming you, I expect you to be responsible for the reality, even though it all comes from inside my own mind. If I try to control you through punishment, I'm kidding myself into believing that by changing you, I will never be forced to experience my pain again. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Changing someone else will not, cannot change your reality. Only you can initiate and carry out that process. Only you can change what's in your mind. It also takes a lot of energy to keep the live projection in place and prevent the truth from entering your awareness.
Put that way, Michael, I can see the conflict. It is in my own thinking. I'm trying to achieve an unreachable goal, and I get so frustrated that I exhaust myself. That is so obvious now, and I see that it's been sapping my energy. A friend who's a medical doctor recently told me the most common complaint he hears is about lack of energy. He called it chronic fatigue. I'm starting to understand that the source of my tiredness is this. It's like I've been carrying a ton of weight on my shoulders.
Richard's tendency to run from conflict provided an example for us to examine the dynamics of projection in his life. I explained, in a relationship based on projection, each believes the other is responsible for the output of his or her mind and carries their own hidden, unhealed upsets as a burden. As a result, each mind has a distorted picture of what is actually happening. This distortion results from blockage of truth. The mind projects its own errors onto others and cannot see the truth about itself. The mind has unconsciously used its hidden information to build its image of them. We then pretend that our mind's image is a true and accurate picture of the outside world when it is only a true and accurate picture of what's happening inside of us. It is just a projection that reflects a condition in our own minds. When projection occurs, each person expects others to be responsible for his or her thoughts and realities. Each, in effect, wants the other to change his or her mind. As a result, each mind distorts its picture of actuality. The distortion results from blockage of truth, which is inherent in the act of projecting. The blocked mind experiences powerlessness because it's cut off from truth, not because another person has the power. We have done ourselves a major disservice when we project, for we've cut ourselves off from the part of our belief system that needs healing.
You mean it's all an inside job? As long as I project and externalize my projections, I pretend that you are responsible for my reality, and by so doing, I block the truth?
Mm-hmm.
Being out of touch with the truth is at the root of feeling powerless.
Yes.
Once I grasp that it is my holding on that keeps me re-experiencing the same painful scenarios, I can get out of this cycle by using these tools.
That's it.
This is actually starting to make sense. I'm surprised. I feel hopeful. I think there's something I can do. I've always been terrified around women, and I didn't understand how I could feel that helpless in front of someone who was 8 inches shorter and 60 pounds lighter than I am. Now I see that whenever I hold a reality based on the belief that I'm powerless, anyone who triggers that reality in me can make me believe that I'm powerless. Is that right?
Richard was close in his understanding. No one can actually make another feel anything. However, others can trigger the internal mechanism, and whatever is there will surface. Richard, if you have a reality called powerlessness, and someone stimulates that belief about yourself, you will experience the effects of that belief as feelings of powerlessness. Keep in mind that you feel something because that reality is within you. No one can make you experience a reality that you haven't already created within yourself. If you mistake them as the cause of your reality, your upset and feelings, you will seem to be their victim. If you know how feelings are formulated within yourself and take corrective action, forgive, each painful situation will simply be an opportunity to heal.
Why should I forgive them?
I didn't suggest forgiving them, Richard. I suggested forgiving the realities in your mind. True forgiveness does not mean letting someone else off the hook. You can't forgive anyone for anything. True forgiveness is a tool for changing realities in your own mind. But I'd like to hold that topic for more detail later. Richard, some of the ideas in this work are difficult to accept at first because the brain cells must be built to even see them. Have you noticed how much we resist being made aware of the truth of things we'd rather hide from ourselves? Most people have had experience of trying to point out what someone didn't want to hear. I like to call the dynamic of hiding information from ourselves blockage of truth, lockage on error. This condition results in a total lock on one's own projection, externalization process, and an inability to see anything but error until the internal process of forgiveness occurs. Have you noticed how difficult it is for a person in denial to see what to others is so obvious? If you pretend your life is the responsibility of others and that you have nothing to do with creating the painful emotions and the repetitious conflicts in your life, you tell yourself a disempowering lie, and in so doing, hide the truth from yourself. Many things influence our view of life and relationships, often without our awareness. Family patterns, parental messages, blame, projection, old behavior patterns, blocks to truth, and false forgiveness all play their part in how we interact with each other. Relationships don't die. They are killed by unconsciously driven behaviors. Since most people blame others for what happens to them, they quote-unquote forgive by letting others off the hook. Notice how predictable the results are when people act out their old patterns, refuse to look at themselves responsibly, and think they are forgiving.
Well, what if I need to be forgiven for something I've done?
Well, Richard, we've been taught an error about forgiveness. The act you are asking about is called pardoning. If you've made an error and wish to be excused for it, you have need of pardon, not forgiveness. Until we learn the true meaning of forgiveness, we substitute pardoning and think that forgiveness has occurred. The act of pardoning does nothing to change the internal reality structure of the person doing the pardoning. It leaves the painful internal reality in place, ready to be triggered again. It also means that the person who is pardoning will usually try to gain control of those pardoned so they will not trigger the pain again. When people forgive each other, using the misunderstood form of forgiveness, they let each other off the hook. Then each mind still has its invisible blockages and painful realities. The only way that what has been blocked in a mind becomes visible is as pain and upset projected into that mind's image of others. Each mind then keeps its distance, viewing the other as the source of pain. Each tends to avoid a real relationship with them because they fear their internalized pain will be triggered again. The more often either of them quote-unquote forgives the other in this erroneous sense, the more likely they are to think of them as the problem and the more separation they will create. Richard was agitated at being challenged again with the idea that he caused his own pain. He proceeded to read me the riot act.
Well, that's the way it is. Other people have always been the cause of almost every problem. If only they would think and act logically.
I suppose thinking logically means thinking like you do?
Oh.
That reminds me of the old definition of a genius, someone who agrees with me. Thinking someone else is to blame is a good defense, Richard. But remember, you're the only one who's been there every time. You're the common link in every event. I went on to refresh Richard's memory, something we all need from time to time. Whether or not we're aware of it, whether or not we choose responsibility, we are involved in setting up everything that happens to us. We are creative beings. This work is based on responsibility, and it is your hostility that needs healing. You just torture yourself, give away your power, and make healing impossible by projection and externalization and holding on to blame. The tendency then is to want to get even with them for what you have done to yourself. A total waste of time, energy, and life.
Okay, okay. I've been there every time. I know this is something that I need to work through, and I will. Do you have any coffee? Oh, and I need a cigarette, too.
Well, Richard, you're holding your breath. When denial, projection, externalization, and holding your breath don't keep the truth hidden, and the drug hostility is confronted and made illogical, as we've just done, the mind prompts us to turn to some other form of suppression. Notice your stress levels elevating because you're confronting something painful, your responsibility and your belief in victimhood. I suggest that caffeine and nicotine are ways you suppress your feelings. If you use those drugs to relieve stress and block truth, chances are you're addicted to them. The effect of drugs is to assist you in hiding from the truth by keeping your projections and locking on to error, actions that seem to protect you from your pain. In truth, drugs function as anesthetics, distorting the mind's output and disguising your pain while destroying your body.
Well, I've heard that caffeine is hard on the pancreas and the adrenals and that smoking contributes to disease processes, but I'm sure that medical research will solve that problem. I've smoked for years and it hasn't hurt me.
I really didn't bother to point out his hacking cough and his shortness of breath. In the ancient Aramaic, there was a statement that went something like, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. That idea means that we will form cunning defenses and protective mechanisms that shield from the conscious mind the results of whatever we've decided to do, especially if our behavior is self-destructive. A clue that a self-destructive behavior is our treasure is that we defend it, though it is harmful to ourselves or others. When you're out of harmony with the lawful, orderly process of life, and as a result, a behavior is producing disease, Richard, I suggest you do whatever is required to change it and stop looking for ways to defend it. I express my amazement at how people engage in behavior proven to be destructive and defend their right to do that behavior while insisting that doctors or government find a cure for them. Notice, for instance, how many people drink to excess on a daily basis and keep searching for a way to cure their hangovers. The cure is simple. Stop the behavior. Don't drink. The problem with that solution for the average person is that with the defense mechanism out of the way, they will have to confront and deal with their treasure. I've just challenged your treasure, your belief in victimhood and blame, and I invite you to notice that the next level of your defense mechanism is now in view. The need to protect yourself from feeling the pain of being responsible for your victimhood and blame thoughts, I suspect, is behind your holding your breath and your desire for the drugs, coffee, and nicotine. Owning up to responsibility for what happens in your life gives you back your power. It is a healing action. And now what you need to forgive next is being felt. How about letting go of the need for the cigarette and the coffee for the next hour or so and just see if anything more comes up?
I've noticed that I have a tendency to smoke more when I'm upset, but I've never understood why. Okay, I'll give it a try. I'll hold off the smoking.
Hold off the anesthetizing drugs, feel fully your painful realities, and engage in the process of true forgiveness. That's where your healing waits for you. Most people, once they have clarity about the cause of the pain in their lives, are excited and eager to go to work on taking care of issues which need to be resolved. Richard was the exception. When I spoke again of true forgiveness being the solution, he went ballistic.
Forgiveness. Now, come on. I've been listening to you about your explanations, but I've tried forgiveness. It changes nothing.
Take another deep breath, Richard. Remember I spoke of letting go of the dialogue in your head? I invite you to listen to my words, not your past realities about forgiveness and the negative associations you've made. The way forgiveness is commonly taught is only a shadow of its true meaning and function. In this culture, we've generally accepted a substitute for true forgiveness. Due to our own ignorance, we bought into the common belief that forgiveness means letting them off the hook for the terrible things they've done to us. This is a Greek concept. It comes from a mindset that externalized everything and attributed cause to the outside world. This is not how true forgiveness was originally presented, and not even close to the original Aramaic concept. Engaging in true forgiveness is required to heal. I personally believe that human beings and even civilizations cannot survive long-term without it. Observe the direction our culture has been moving, and I think you'll see what I mean.
Now, you've mentioned Aramaic several times. Does that have something to do with religion? If so, I'm really not interested in hearing about it.
The Aramaic language is an ancient tongue spoken by the originators of at least five of the world's major religions. Religions address the topic of forgiveness, of course, but the topic itself is not the exclusive property of the religions. We need not speak of forgiveness in a religious context in order to experience its enormous practical value.
Well, for me, forgiveness has always been linked to religion. Something like that doesn't interest me. It's never occurred to me that it could be useful in a practical sense outside of a religious context. Okay, tell me more about this Aramaic. Why is it so important?
Well, according to historians, the Aramaic language sprang to life fully matured. It is not based on any other known language. There was no developmental period, nor any known place of origin. Aramaic is one of the oldest spoken and written languages in the world. It was the language of the day throughout the Persian and Babylonian empires. From at least 1000 BC to 1000 AD, Aramaic could be heard from the Mediterranean to the Great Wall of China. It is still spoken today in some villages of Lebanon and in the mountains of northern Iraq. The Zoroastrian, Hebrew, Christian, Islamic, and Baha'i faiths were all originally taught in Aramaic, and it is the language of many of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was the native tongue of Moses, Abraham, Jesus, Muhammad, and Baha'u'llah.
Well, how does that relate to my 20th century mind?
The Aramaic language and culture impart a practical understanding of human behavior and clearly explain how the mind works. It has the ability to convey deep psychological meanings by adding prefixes and suffixes to root words, an ability unknown in any other language. It seems to me that it has this ability because the Aramaic peoples had an understanding that no other culture has acquired to date. This ancient language encompasses a technology desperately needed to heal our culture. The level of comprehension of human function reflected in Aramaic is unknown in the West. And what today is thought of as religion was then simply guidance for daily living. It taught people how to best handle their family lives, relationships, sexuality, business, taxes, legal matters, land, crops, inheritance, and finances. Unfortunately, its advice has been, for the most part, ignored and thought of as antiquated by the modern mind. It is a thought structure so radically different from what most of us have been taught that, when first confronted, it shocks the Western mind.
Well, it still sounds like a religious spiel to me.
Richard, can you let go of the conversation in your head long enough to hear that there might be more in the scriptures than your idea of religion? Investigate genuine spiritual teachings, and you will find that they're about life. They deserve serious consideration. In truth, they are simply an owner's manual for your life, relationships, and body.
Oh, well, okay, you've got my curiosity. What you said so far makes sense, so I'll go ahead and listen.
Once you go beneath the misinterpretations and grasp the original Aramaic thought structure in the scriptures, you will experience a clarity that is profound. What today is called religion has its roots in solid, down-to-earth guidance. The original intention of religion was to create a community where it was safe and nurturing to live differently than the insanity we humans have created in the world. A community that taught people how life worked and instructed people how to achieve the best life had to offer and processed them through the world's insanity. Many religions still hold fast to this as their goal. Do you recall hearing quotes in the scriptures like, "Do not judge by appearances, do not defile the temple, the wages of sin is death"?
Well, yes, and it's never made a lick of sense to me either. When I was a kid, I heard hypocrites spouting this stuff all the time. They would do the exact opposite when they thought that no one was looking. It sure turned me off.
I hear that it was confusing to see people not walking their talk. With the amount of energy and resistance you have around this conversation, I suspect you were abused due to their hypocrisy, were you?
My folks talked about love and honesty at church. but they beat me up verbally and physically. They did that at home. If I spoke up or asked why they acted so differently in public, the beatings doubled. I had to lie to keep the family secrets. I had to be dishonest in order to make it look like everything was okay, or I'd be punished. Keeping up with appearances was demanded of me. It was pretty crazy. While I was being lectured to on the value of telling the truth, I was required to live a lie. I saw hypocrisy in the minister and the deacons, lots of people. They were always telling me I was a sinner, and that was painful.
Take a breath, Richard. Holding your breath is exactly how you acquire a past about something and carry it with you. Holding your breath attaches the pain of an experience to a reality in the mind. If that reality is triggered, even though external circumstances do not justify it, there will be pain. Richard, has it occurred to you that just because someone could not live up to a teaching does not mean the teaching has no value or that the problem lies within the teaching? It sounds like one of the issues was your parents' inability to live up to their ideals. That does not make them good or bad. It simply means that, like all humans, they were not perfect. It seems you attach the imperfection and abuse of your parents to their religion. Projecting and externalizing your pain onto religion makes it difficult for you to see any benefit in it, and you lose as a result. I've seen many who simultaneously abandon their relationship with their parents and their spiritual support systems in this fashion.
I guess my parents have the right to be human, too. Perhaps I'm expecting too much of them. I can see they were just trying and doing the best that they could. I feel relieved in just knowing that.
That insight is a result of forgiveness. It's a small but significant example of how forgiveness works.
What do you mean?
Well, in your mind, you had a reality, a file, so to speak, called My Parent or Parents Should Have Been Perfect. According to your perception, they weren't, and you attached the pain, abuse, and resentment you experienced with them to your mind's file on parents. Whenever the reality parent was triggered, your perception of them or yourself as a parent was clouded by the complex of thoughts and feelings in that file. In Aramaic, forgive means to cancel. The minute you loosened your grip on your need for them to be perfect, in effect, you canceled your need for that perfection. The result of that action is your parent file opened and the abuse, pain, and resentment it contained began to release. This is true forgiveness in Aramaic. Certainly a radically different action than letting them off the hook. As the cloud over your perception of them lifted, a painful reality was in process of being forgiven, and you can now see them more realistically.
I'm not sure I've heard everything you just said, but I sure feel relieved.
You're not the only one who will experience relief, Richard. This release will impact not only your mother and father, but due to the new clarity in your parent file, your capacity to parent will also be enhanced. Notice your parents were not involved in this process, and neither they nor the actualities of the past have changed. Yet you feel better. You are always in charge of your feelings, and no change is required of anyone but you in order for you to heal. Our natural state is happiness. The human being is designed to feel good. Just observe the ease and happiness of a child before it is impacted by our cultural insanities.
You said that the release process began, Michael. Does that mean that it's not complete? Will I have to go through more of this pain?
Healing is not an event, it's a process. It takes time and happens in stages. You will tend to experience your process as painful as long as you resist it and want to hold on.
Well, how long will it take?
As long as it takes. And it can be a pleasant, exciting, and easy experience. Unfortunately, many, because of resistance, don't go through it easily. It is an individual process that can be accelerated.
Well, I'd like to know how.
There are many factors that determine how quickly you move through healing, how easily you process. These include nutrition, exercise, your support system, and a host of other factors. The best way I know to accelerate healing is to apply what I call cosmic grace. It is the willingness to tell the truth and embrace with love what you find inside. It speeds process immeasurably. Repeatedly hiding your truth in relationship causes the resentment that eats away goodwill. Unspoken and unacknowledged realities become attached to the mind's images of others and eventually turn to anger, resentment, and hatred.
I've heard of changing the past. Is that what I've just done?
Your forgiveness did not change the past, but it changed the reality in your mind about the past. You released some of the old unspoken realities that, until now, were attached to your brain's image of your parents. There is no need to carry the pain of old realities. Your relief and release are a good example of the successful use of true forgiveness. It is wise to remember a success like this if resistance to change surfaces in the future. Give yourself a pat on the back. Go ahead, actually pat your back. It's more than a cliche. Intentionally emphasizing the positive effects of an action or an attitude is known as a positive anchor. When you anchor things through this kind of emphasis, you will be more inclined to repeat them in the future.
I'm kind of sensing what you're saying, Michael, but I'm still a little overwhelmed. I feel better, but I'm still confused, and I don't know why. I'm not sure I quite understand what just happened.
Richard, as you undo old patterns, some confusion is normal. Bringing your conflicting thoughts and feelings to the surface as you heal creates that kind of effect. Your relief in the situation with your parents came from spontaneous forgiveness, the kind that happens in an accidental and haphazard fashion. One of the primary tools we offer, which you can learn to use and take home with you, is called the Reality Management Worksheet. The purpose for this tool is to teach, on an experiential level, how both joy and pain are created. It is a reliable scientific method you can use at any time to let pain go and really embrace joy.
If what you're saying is true, I want it.